We believe that the court erred in vastly expanding what's called the Federal Reserve Water Rights Doctrine.
The state seeks review of the subsistence rights case known as Katie John. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage woman finds success on the health insurance marketplace.
The website sucks, I'm not going to lie. But the idea that I might actually be able to afford health insurance is huge to me.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
The state is taking on the federal government in court again. As KUAC's Dan Ross reports, the case involves states' rights and control of rivers.
The state of Alaska is requesting review of a court decision that backs federal subsistence management of state-owned waters. State Senior Assistant Attorney General Mike Mitchell says the state is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals' July 2013 ruling in the state versus Interior Secretary Sally Jewell case,
which is also the most recent in the line of Katie John cases addressing federal subsistence jurisdiction.
The late Athabascan elder Katie John successfully fought for a federal rural subsistence priority on Alaska rivers passing through national parks and refuges. Mitchell says the Jewell case decision extends federal control to include waters adjacent to parks. He says the state is contesting the Ninth Circuit's reliance on a 1908 established policy that lined out Indian reservation water rights.
We believe that the court erred in vastly expanding what's called the Federal Reserve Water Rights Doctrine to allow the federal government to assert federal jurisdiction in waters not only in but adjacent to national parks and refuges. That doctrine was really established to determine the water that's necessary for federal reservations in the arid West, and it's never been applied in this context before.
Mitchell says the water rights doctrine is being applied despite the absence of any clear congressional intent in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act to strip control of waters from the state. The state lost a related case last week. In the John Sturgeon case ruling, a federal judge backed National Park Service authority to regulate state waters passing through its lands. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Officials with the Alaska Federation of Natives gathered today in Anchorage, Juneau, and Bethel on a teleconference to denounce the state's lawsuit. Newly elected AFN co-chair Tara Sweeney said subsistence defines Alaska Native people, and she said no one has the right to take that away.
The latest action by the state of Alaska is an assault upon the people of Alaska who depend upon hunting, fishing, and gathering to feed their families.
AFN President Julie Kitka gave a brief history of the complicated case. Kitka said for decades, AFN has attempted to work with state administrations, Congress, and in court. She said Native leaders expected the first Katie John case to resolve the federal lands and waters management issue.
Unfortunately, the state has continued to fight implementation of that decision.
Kitka said AFN has been involved in the litigation for more than 18 years and will continue to intervene on the side of the federal government while working toward a congressional fix. Rosita Worrell is the chairwoman of AFN's Subsistence Committee. She said she wanted to be clear about three main things: that AFN will continue the fight to protect subsistence in this case and any others that compromise those rights; that although they have tried for two decades to work on a legislative or congressional fix, the state has refused to participate in a viable solution; and finally,
the state of Alaska's attempted overreach is a reckless attempt to unravel the precedent set by the lower courts and through administrative procedures. This should enrage not only the Native community, but all Alaskans. Too much time, energy, and precious funding has been wasted in the state's ongoing attacks on subsistence. Enough is enough.
Kitka and Worrell both reiterated that the state could regain subsistence management of federal lands if it came into compliance with ANILCA. The Obama administration claims it has fixed some of the problems with the new online federal health insurance marketplace, but so far Alaskans remain mostly shut out. Senator Lisa Murkowski had a chance to grill the top official in charge of the website at a Senate hearing today, and she used it to air some of her frustrations. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Murkowski told Medicare Chief Marilyn Tavner that she's met with Enroll Alaska insurance agents who are trying to help Alaskans buy insurance on the exchange. As of last week, they had signed only 3 people up for coverage. Now they suspect the website miscalculated their subsidy. Tavner had few real answers for Murkowski.
Not only can people not get on to Enroll, but if they do, their subsidy calculations are incorrect.
So we are aware, meaning the staff is aware of this issue, and they are working on a fix to the system to correct the Alaska issue.
In the meantime,
to Alaska.
What should Alaskans do? Should they stay off, as Enroll Alaska and the other navigators have suggested?
Tavner said Alaskans should keep trying. Murkowski also criticized Tavner for taking the site offline from 1 to 5 a.m. daily. That's the middle of the night on the East Coast, but it means the website goes dark at 9 p.m. in Alaska. Prime time, says Murkowski, for busy parents who've just put kids to bed. Tavner said Alaskans can call the helpline or submit paper applications. Meanwhile, more than half of the Alaskans who buy individual policies from Primera are getting cancellation notices. At the hearing, Murkowski said many have told her they worry they'll have a gap in coverage if they can't enroll on the federal exchange in time and that they might get sick during the gap.
They want to know, if I fall through the cracks, am I going to be taken care of? And I don't have an answer for him.
Outside the hearing, Murkowski said she believes the key to getting truly affordable health care plans is to work on legislation that will lower the cost of the health care itself. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Despite extensive problems with healthcare.gov, a few dozen Alaskans have managed to enroll in health plans on the marketplace. Anchorage hairstylist Lara Immler is one of them. She credits a degree in computer programming for helping her get through the process. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
In 2004, Lara Immler quit her job as an accountant to become a hairstylist. Now she rents space in a small salon in Midtown Anchorage. She's a lot happier cutting hair than she was sitting in front of a computer.
All right, I'm going to show you the back so it's better now.
Awesome, yay, I'm
good.
So happy.
Yeah, you're all done, my dear.
Cool, thank you.
You're welcome.
She loves making people feel better about themselves, but she does miss one big thing about her old job.
I had health insurance with a pretty big corporate office for about 6 years, and it was wonderful.
Even without health insurance, Immler spends a lot of time in doctor's offices. The 37-year-old has Hashimoto's disease, an autoimmune disorder that affects the thyroid. The treatments and blood work she needs are expensive, but not as expensive as monthly health premiums.
Being self-employed, getting my premium at anything reasonable wasn't happening. I think my last quote was $1,200 a month for myself.
Immler was determined to find a better deal on the new Affordable Care Act marketplace. She logged on to healthcare.gov a few days after it went live last month. She tried on and off for the first week, but kept running into messages that the site was unavailable. So she decided to wait a few weeks. On October 24th, she logged back in and slowly started making her way through the process.
So you get to a point where you finally get to pick what health insurance you want, and all the buttons have to be double-clicked. If you don't know that or try it, it doesn't go anywhere. It just sits there.
So it's not like it says double-click here.
No, this website is so not user-friendly. You can't even figure out what they're trying to get you to do unless you accidentally get there.
Immler has a degree in computer programming. She's even built a few websites. She thinks that experience helped her persevere through the trouble spots on healthcare.gov. About 2 hours after she started, she landed on a screen that told her she had successfully enrolled. She was pleasantly surprised by the price. Immler qualified for subsidies and chose a mid-level plan that will cost her $110 a month.
The website sucks, I'm not going to lie. It's awful. It's cumbersome. It's a lot of work to even figure out what they're trying to get you to do. So the website is awful. But the idea that I might actually be able to afford health insurance, is huge to me. It will be a huge burden off my family.
Immler is still waiting for enrollment confirmation from her new insurance company. She's optimistic that will come soon. If it doesn't, she's willing to log back into healthcare.gov to keep trying. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a plea for help from St. Lawrence Island after a record low walrus harvest.
Every family on the island are suffering economic disaster, and they're spending their cash resources to get food from other sources.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
The U.S. Senate last night voted to move ahead with a bill to protect gay people from workplace discrimination. Sponsors expected Senator Lisa Murkowski to be one of a handful of Republicans who would help them get the 60 votes needed to proceed, but Murkowski was absent.
I had made a commitment to be in Midland, Texas, looking at how Midland and some of the operators in Midland are responding to this amazing, extraordinary boom in oil shale production.
A spokesman says she also attended a fundraiser in Texas. She says when she found out the Senate was going to take a rare Monday vote, she tried to get back in time, but didn't make it. The anti-discrimination bill cleared the 60-vote hurdle without her. It is expected to pass the Senate, and Murkowski says she looks forward to voting for it. Today is Election Day in states like New Jersey and Virginia, where there are big governor's races. But even though voters aren't going to the polls in Alaska, it's not totally quiet here. A group that wants to remove state legislator Lindsey Holmes from office is turning in their recall application tomorrow morning. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Recall sponsors believe that the Anchorage representative is unfit for office because she changed her party affiliation from Democrat to Republican before starting her term. They've collected over 1,000 signatures from people supporting their application, and at least 800 of those need to come from registered voters in Holmes's district. Weegee Tazi is helping lead the effort, and he says he's confident that most of their signatures are valid.
One of the things that Representative Holmes might have been counting on is the complacency of the voters in her district. And we're not complacent.
The recall process is long and complicated. Once the application is submitted, the Division of Elections verifies the signatures and judges the argument for the recall. If the application is accepted, sponsors then have to collect another round of signatures, this time from 25% of the district's voters. Tazi says that they have volunteers ready to knock on doors, and they have plenty of tennis ball bumper stickers to hand out, referencing a controversial appropriation for tennis courts that Holmes supported. If the sponsors trigger a special election and the recall question is successful, Holmes would have to give up her office. But there wouldn't be a follow-up election to replace her. Her seat would be treated like any other vacancy, where the governor has a month to decide on an appointment. Because of the recall group's timing, there is the possibility that that could happen during the legislative session. Tazi says he would rather have no representation over Holmes.
Regardless of what happens in the legislature, in terms of whether or not we would create a vacancy in the middle of the session, is in some respects besides the point. You cannot abuse the process like that and expect people to just stand by.
There has never been a successful attempt to recall a legislator in Alaska. A group of Ketchikan voters tried to remove then-Representative Kyle Johansson from office in 2011, but the Division of Elections rejected the argument that renouncing his leadership position and caucus membership qualified as incompetence and neglect of duties. Holmes did not respond to a request for an interview in time for this story. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Serious arson seems to be on the rise in Anchorage for 2013. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
In August, someone intentionally set several fires in a heavily wooded section of Russian Jack Springs Park. And in October, a man was caught on surveillance tape setting the roof of a Mountain View pawn shop ablaze. These are just two of the 88 cases investigator Brian Belega is juggling right now. Belega says that number includes those carried over from years past, and he's actively investigating 54 of them.
I'm almost doubled. Last year, I dealt with 25 arsons. This year, my arsons since January 1st, 2013 is 40.
Of the 40 arson cases from 2013, just a handful have been concluded. That's not including the many smaller arsons that are routinely handled by the Anchorage Police Department. This year, APD has handled 24 arson cases for a total of 64 total arson cases in Anchorage so far. What concerns Belega, he says, is that he's seeing more serious commercial arsons.
This is the most commercial arsons I've seen. I actually got four of them since the first of the year. That's unusual for me to see that many of them.
Last year, Belega says he didn't have any commercial arson cases, and it's unusual to have more than one a year. Fire Chief Chris Bashu confirms that more serious arson is occurring in Anchorage this year.
The numbers are what the numbers are. I've tried to make sure that we're not reporting more, that there's actually more out there, and it appears to be the case there's actually more out there.
Belega is the only fire investigator for the municipality of Anchorage. He's worked in the position since 2008. In the 1980s, there were several investigators, but over the years, the other positions were eliminated. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Investigators are trying to determine what sparked the fire that destroyed a maintenance building at a North Pole cement plant on Monday morning. No one was injured, but the owners of HC Ready Mix are feeling the pain of a multi-million dollar loss caused by the fire, which not only destroyed the building, but also several pieces of heavy equipment inside. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
North Star Volunteer Fire Chief Jeff Tucker estimates the big fire that destroyed the HC Ready Mix maintenance building and its contents caused $3 million in damage. Tucker says that estimate includes the several pieces of equipment that were in the shop when it was destroyed by the fire that was reported just before 11 a.m. Monday. Those include a road grader, dump truck, and a concrete mixer truck. Tucker says investigators haven't yet identified the official cause of the fire, but on the scene Monday, he noted that a couple of men were in the building when the fire broke out.
The folks on scene who were working on were either doing some welding or some grinding, which apparently caused some sparks that possibly caught the inside was lined with the polyurethane spray-on foam, and possibly that caught on fire. That might have been the cause, but it's still under investigation. That's an early report.
The explosions and black smoke caught the attention of John Jadzak, a North Pole man who'd just walked into the Circle M bar and restaurant just down the street from the Ready Mix plant.
I walked here about 10:30, and I was coming in, and I heard pow, pow. And then we come out, it's like, came out here, man, it was just bad, man. It was like blowing all over the joint.
HC Ready Mix owner Bill Hoopel was out of town Monday and unavailable for comment. He didn't return phone calls. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The parent company of Juneau Electric Utility, Alaska Electric Light and Power, has agreed to merge with Spokane, Washington-based Avista Corporation. Alaska Energy and Resources Company will join Avista subsidiary Avista Utilities by July 2014, pending the approval of state and federal regulators, as well as AERC shareholders. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Bill Corbis and his family have owned a piece of Alaska Electric Light and Power almost from the day the company was founded. His grandfather and a great uncle bought into the utility in 1896 when it was only 2 years old. Corbis started working for AEL&P in 1970 and went on to serve 8 years as president and CEO in two separate stints. Even after he retired in 2002, Corbis and his family remained the majority owners of Alaska Energy and Resources, AEL&P's parent company. But Corbis says they've reached a turn in the road, and now is the time to sell.
I'm 76 years old. There is no Corbis family member here to continue to be involved with the company at the board of directors level or as part of the employment team.
Corbis says there would be inheritance tax obligations if the company is not sold before he dies. He also says several AERC shareholders are looking to sell their stock, and the company wants new sources of capital for future projects to provide energy to the utility's nearly 16,000 customers. He says AERC wanted a buyer that would focus on three things: providing reliable and competitively priced electric service, being a good corporate citizen in Juneau, and taking care of AEL&P's employees. Corbis says the company had other suitors, but in the end,
the management team and the board of directors decided that Avista was, in our case, was by far the best match.
Current AEL&P president and CEO Tim McLeod says the two companies have a number of similarities.
Other than they being much bigger than we are, we felt like we're very similar in corporate values and corporate culture.
Dennis Vermillion, president of Avista Utilities, sees that too. The company was founded in Spokane in 1889 as part of an effort to build a power station on the Spokane River.
We're very much like AEL&P in that we started, you know, really in a very small community over 100 years ago with a foundation of hydroelectric energy.
Today, Avista serves more than 600,000 customers with electricity and natural gas in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Montana. Vermillion says Avista sees an excellent growth opportunity in AEL&P.
A big deal for us, it fits nicely from a strategic perspective in what we're trying to do, and that is grow our utility business and diversify our energy assets.
And while he admits it won't happen for several years, he says there also could be opportunities to grow Avista's natural gas business in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. AEL&P's headquarters will remain in Juneau, and Avista has promised to retain all of its 60 full-time employees for at least 2 years after the transaction closes. As for Corbis, he plans to stay on until the ownership transition is complete. And at the very end of Monday's press conference announcing the deal, he said he has plans for his share of the Avista stock.
It is my intent to sign over 90% of my new Avista shares to the Juneau Community Foundation.
The Community Foundation helps donors direct charitable funds to nonprofits in Juneau. It named Corbis Philanthropist of the Year in 2012 for his many years of community giving. Corbis says he's not sure how much the gift will total until the sale is complete, but he guesses it will be somewhere north of $40 million. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Kowarik recently sent out letters to Alaska senators and congressmen urging them to provide aid to the two communities on St. Lawrence Island. As the letter details, residents of Savunga and Gamble are struggling with the worst subsistence harvest on record. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Freezers are empty at a time of year when they'd normally be fully stocked with walrus, seal, whale, fish, and bird. And the lack of ivory from last spring's devastatingly low walrus harvest has meant a shortage of cash that's needed for heating oil, gasoline, basic necessities, and supplemental food. Pura Mikulski is vice president of Kowarik's Community Service Division. She says all 330 households on St. Lawrence Island are grappling with the devastating harvest.
Every family on the island are suffering economic disaster, and they're spending their cash resources to get food from other sources, and so it's affecting their ability to heat their homes, to purchase the gasoline and the bullets and hunting equipment to go and get food for their families.
Quirik sent the letter to Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich, as well as State Representatives Donnie Olson and Neil Foster. The letter highlights the long-term economic and development projects Quirik and the two communities have worked on, but Mikulski says the authors stress that St. Lawrence Island's present concerns are much more immediate and need direct assistance to divert a looming crisis.
We're glad that that's been recognized as an economic disaster, but there's been no support or follow-up or extra consideration given by the communities, by the state and federal agencies, and it's going to take a concerted effort to provide assistance to the families on the island this year. More needs to be done to meet the needs on the island this year.
Part of the difficulty in coordinating response is that there's no state or federal protocol for dealing with an economic disaster. The state of Alaska sets money aside to assist victims of flooding and other natural disasters, but no such funds exist to help purchase vital supplies amid unanticipated economic events. A partial plan has been drafted to supply each family with half a reindeer from the herd on the island's south side, but logistics are proving difficult. Coordinating a large reindeer slaughter, as well as transporting meat back to Gamble and Savunga, requires costly fuel, and half a reindeer carcass will not carry a household through the winter. Not only was the walrus harvest a third of its yearly average, but alternative sources of protein, like fish and birds, were also scarce.
It was just a bad year for weather, with ice conditions that were very difficult, and the numbers of the harvest were very low.
Right now, only one organization is mobilizing to provide aid to Gamble and Savunga ahead of winter. Alaska Community Action on Toxics is working to collect $35,000 by December 1st to get immediate assistance to residents. Quirik does not have the money to fully fund a relief effort on St. Lawrence Island, but the organization is hoping their most recent letters will spur federal and state officials to act. Reporting in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Zachariah Hughes in Nome. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.